For those of you that came in after the study, can you hear me okay? I'll go ahead and mention this, that Mr. Dart wrote out a letter to all the ministry and mentioned that Mr. Lee had called and that Lonnie Lee, in extensive tests, is now completely free of cancer, according to the doctor. There's no cancer remaining whatsoever. So please pass that on. That was really great good news to hear about. I'll wait till we get some audio back here before continuing. Can you hear now? Okay. Will I repeat it again? Okay. It was a part of the announcement that I made before Bible study that Mrs. Lonnie Lee is now completely free of cancer, according to the doctor. And, of course, we'd all been praying for her for a long time now and had thought that it was perhaps terminal or inoperable or whatever. And it was really great good news to hear that she had been apparently completely healed. You all set now? Okay. What are your problems if you were to analyze what they are as you sit here today? I can think of many that I have. I could start on physical pains. We could all do that. We could start on financial problems, spiritual problems, problems of attitude, of personal health, mental, and emotional problems. And yet, any problem you have, whether it's a matter of financial, and that's going to cause worry or resentment or greed, any problem which you have, which is physical in nature, such as physical health, might call to mind pain, resentment over the pain, feeling of somehow being put upon, deep feelings of personal myth at the fact that you are suffering and other people are not. If you have emotional, personal, physical, financial problems, basically every one of those problems would be a problem of your mind, of your character, or a problem of your spirit. Now, there are many things that provoke us spiritually, provoke us mentally, provoke us to personal and emotional problems. Let's turn to the book of Proverbs, Proverbs the 16th chapter and verse 2. I'm going to be reading a few of these to set the stage for what is to come. Proverbs is quite a very deep book. I once had an argument with a gentleman who was taking a course in speed reading, and he was telling me how many hundreds and hundreds of words he could read a minute, and I challenged him to speed read Proverbs. Well, of course, it cannot be done. And in spite of the fact I didn't win the argument with him, I did in my own mind, but I didn't convince him. The book of Proverbs in 16th chapter, the 16th chapter, verse 2, gives us a basic principle of our human nature. All the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes. We always justify what we do. Even criminals justify that they're stealing it from other people who got it wrongfully. People who dip into the till and are embezzling from the boss probably feel that the boss is taking too much money, or doesn't deserve all the money that is there, that he is very put upon, that he is very poor, that nobody has given him the appreciation, that he is far more valuable to the boss than the boss really remunerates him for, that he is really the person who has caused the boss to make all the money. Besides, he has these terrible, desperate needs, and so he just steals. People who steal on their income tax. Basically, no matter what we do, whether it's a criminal act, whether it's lashing out in shouting matches with our mate or someone that normally we would love, we justify ourselves. Not a one of us looks in the mirror and says, all that I have just been through, all that I have said to this other person was wrong. Oh no, we struggle mightily to convince ourselves that our approach and our attitude is right. How many conversations have you overheard in restaurants and public places? Well, you're hearing a couple of people or three or four people at the table and they're talking. You will never believe what she said to me, blah, 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 blah. And wait till I tell you what he did, blah, 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 blah. And what is this kind of conversation in which we all indulge as we're talking about some third party? It is a desperate attempt on our part to gain support for our point of view, to win people over to believing that we were right, we were righteous. Our approach, our point of view, what we said, our premise, our part in this little problem was correct, and the other person's part was utterly wrong. We are right, and they are wrong. And that's part of our human nature. That's a part of carnal human nature that still is inside of us, even after receiving God's Holy Spirit. All the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes, but the eternal ways the Spirit's. Now, it means that God looks down far deeper than just through rooftops. He looks down through the skull right into that part of our brain or our mind that the spiritual essence resides in, that part of our brain or our mind which is our personality, which is our character, that is really the true you. And God looks right down into the deepest thoughts of our heart, and He weighs and He assesses and He appraises our spirit, meaning our attitude, our point of view, how we look at things, how we react emotionally to things. Let's read a few more of these scriptures which set the stage for what is going to come. Let's drop down to verse 32 of the 16th chapter. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit than he that takes a city. Now, I have known a lot of people that are instant anger. It's just like the Atari toy that you buy for television. You punch the button and the little spaceship shoots out a whole stream of missiles to shoot down the lunar landing ship that's attacking your fortress or whatever. It's instant. You cross them. You say something to them. You disagree with them, and they are angry instantly. We have up in our closet there in the office instant soup. I can go in there, and there's hot boiling water, and I can take that little thing and tear it open and put it in a paper cup, and I pour the water in there, and instantly I've got soup. It takes me less than 30 seconds to make it. Now, I know people that can get to a boiling point much more quickly than I can make that soup. And you can depend upon them. There isn't any doubt in your mind that you know the formula for certain people in your immediate circle of friends whom you can in anger to the point of absolute rage, and all you got to do is push the right buttons. Now, you shouldn't do that, because if they don't have control of their spirit, and they are still vulnerable, and they're the kind of people that can become instantly angry to the point of passion beyond sanity by something you say or you do, then don't ever do that, because you have your input and God is going to hold you accountable. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty. Do we really believe that? You know, there was a very mighty man. His name was Dwight Eisenhower. He was very far down on the list of graduates at West Point, and really a very junior officer when World War II began, but he rose to become one of the greatest generals that the United States had ever known. And he led many, many armies in World War II. And yet, after his presidential tenure of office, lying on his deathbed in Walter Reed Hospital, he called Billy Graham to his side. And here Ike, as he was known and beloved by millions, was worried about his soul that he thought he had. And he asked Dr. Billy Graham, did Graham think he was going to go to heaven? Was he okay? Was he going to make it? Here was a man whose name had conjured up visions of whole armies of mighty armored columns, of tens of thousands of aircraft, of tanks, of howitzers, of millions of troops storming across the entirety of Europe to the heart of the Reich. A man who had other many generals under him and millions of troops under him. And he was lying there, wasted, very elderly, and very sick, and very worried about whether or not he was going to make it. Dr. Billy Graham assured him that his sins were forgiven, and he said, now I can go in peace. Quite a touching thing. He meant it. I'm sure Billy Graham meant it. He just didn't have the total truth that he needed to tell Ike. But on the other hand, Eisenhower died in peace of mind. But you know, we don't really believe that inside ourselves. Is it really better of you, especially if you're a woman, and basically many people tend to put women down, even church organizations do, and you're the kind of a lady who has managed to get complete control of her spirit? Now, my sister Beverly is that way. She's not converted. She's not a member of the Church of God. But I've seen situations in which she has been placed in an environment where just rages are raging around her, and she can smile sweetly and kind of wait until it's all over, and then say something very intelligent and very rational, and it just does not touch her. Now, most other people would be drawn into this rage, this incredible thing happening, this attack against her character or her personality or her children or her home or her appearance or whatever, and it would not only disturb them, but they'd be like the person I described earlier, instant anger, like instant soup, and they would answer back, they would fight back. Not my sister Beverly. She just wait, and she'll just smile serenely when it's all over. She just says something very intelligent, probably something that is a commentary about the attitude of the person who just flew into the rage, but she controls her anger. He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that rules his spirit, and that means, of course, your emotion, your emotional outbursts, he that rules his spirit is better than he that taketh a city, a great general who would actually occupy a foreign city. Some other kind of mind conditioners before we get into what I really want to get to today, and I better hurry. Verse 14, I like this one, it's rather earthy. The beginning of strife, that's an argument. When you say your voices are raising a little higher, and you're getting a little more strident, and you're getting a, well, I don't believe it, and you're getting a couple of rather unkind things out of your friend, you're arguing back and forth. That's the beginning of strife. That's the first escalation beyond just calm disagreement. Emotions are getting involved. That's the beginning of the strife. The beginning of strife is as when one urinates. That's what it really means. Letteth out water. That's verse 14. Did I tell you that? Chapter 17, verse 14. The beginning of strife is as when one urinates, when one lets out water. Therefore, leave off contention. Now, that's one thing we don't do together, even as husband and wife. We don't say, come, dear, let's go to the toilet. You know, we just do not. God has built us in such a way that even though we might know what the bodily processes are, and as parents in training our children and bathing our little naked babies, we're all very accustomed to these little mistakes and accidents of life. One thing we do not do is make public this necessity of life. It is untoward. It is awkward. It's awful. It's just embarrassing. And that's what God says the beginning of strife between two people who should love one another is like. Therefore, leave off contention before, not after, before it be meddled with. And going on to the 18th chapter and verse 14. The spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity, but a wounded spirit, who can bear or who can lift up or change? Someone that is really hurt, who has hurt feelings, whose mind is made up, that they're the person who is the recipient of all the evil, you just can't seem to lift them out of it. Once a person has descended emotionally into hurt feelings and feeling very put upon, there's no way to get them back out of it. Now it says, the spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity. Do you know that doctors have proved that psychosomatic illnesses are perhaps 50%, that 50% of all people that go into doctor's offices or even oftentimes are admitted for psychiatric, not necessarily just hospital care, are caused by a mental attitude that they have even documented clinically, pseudo-pregnancies up to the 9th month where people's bellies actually swelled with gas and so on because their mind told them they were pregnant when they weren't. Now, this is incredible, but it's true. Fits, worries, premature aging, ulcers. We all know that ulcers are caused by the mind, by stress, by an attitude, by constant pressure and hypertension and worry and anger. And upset emotions. And pretty soon, and you know what those emotions do? The emotions are triggers. They're triggering all sorts of little things. You've got all these little green and yellow and orange and red, I like to think of that way, like little plastic sacs. And they're called duodenum and pituitary and adrenaline and by all these strange names, these glands located here and there around your brain and in your vital organs and around in secret places in your body. And when your mind goes crazy, these little sacs are squeezing things into your bloodstream and into your stomach. And it's like green bile. And you get the idea of a stomach like a big rubber bag. And in the bottom of it is this green bilious mixture that is just like melted battery acid. And it's going fizz, pop, you know, and you drop something in it and it just disintegrates. I mean, it would absolutely digest shoe leather. And that's what we do to ourselves, inside ourselves. Our bodies actually are afflicted because of what's going on in our mind. Now, doctors know that in the case of serious illness, many people lose the will to live. And their spirits are very low. And they sink down low, and they just give up. And they die. And do you know that there is a phenomenon, and this has happened in India, and I'm sure it's happened in this country, where perfectly healthy as you or I, can decide because of an enormous emotional trauma, they can just say, I'm going to die. And they can go to bed and lie down, and within hours, long before they fast or starve themselves to death, they die. I can prove it to you. We can research that in the library, and I can show you in medical books cases of perfectly healthy people where they, in their mind, they made up their mind, I am going to die, and they have died. Now, there are other people who are lying there, and they have so much to live for, or even something will happen virtually on their deathbed. A loved one will come in and remind them of their grandchildren, or of something left undone, of great things that they ought to yet accomplish, or convince them how badly their loved ones need them, and give them again the will to live. And if they are given that will to live, the doctors are amazed, they're dumbfounded, the whole prognosis changes immediately, and they go from that horrible low point, and they just start right on up, and they get well. And it's all in here. It has nothing to do with what they're giving them intravenously, or their diet, or what they're doing with regard to the treatment. They have the will to live. Their spirit, something happening in their mind, is positive, and it's saying, I will not give up, I'm going to get well. They get well. It's quite a principle of life. The spirit of a man will sustain his infirmity. But a wounded spirit, when somebody is hurt so deeply, emotionally, in their spirit, their psyche, who can bear it? Who can stand it? And who can ever repair it or lift it up? Proverbs 19 and verse 11. The discretion of a man defers his anger. It is his glory to pass over a transgression. How many people do you know who take instant exception to transgression? We are never quite so comfortable as when we're engrossed in a tale about some other person's sin. We are just like a baby basking with a full stomach and right after the bath and all powdered and just kicking with feet and hands going and gurgling and gooing and making funny little sounds to his mother. We couldn't be happier than with a full stomach over dinner and a second beer bottle in front of us talking about some other person's incredible faux pas, somebody else's omission, somebody else's sin, somebody else's utter stupidity. And we are absolutely delighted as we tell this tale. We are as happy as a cuddly little monkey in somebody's arms, you know, or a little baby, and we just gurgle, and we're just happy. Because the focus of everybody's mind is away from us. It's not on us. It's on this other guy. And that's when we're happy. When we are ripping to bits with our mouth some other human character, the focus is on them, on their tattered character, on their body. It's not on us. And that's when we're comfortable. But now when that light is on us, that spotlight turns around and searches out, and somebody would dare to say to you over a nice dinner, you're all comfortable, you've just finished the last little bit of your Polynesian chicken or whatever, and drinking some beer, and somebody, well, I've got something I want to tell you about that you did last week that really bothered me. Now, you might as well be like this bull beer or malt liquor ad. That's like the bull walking right through the wall. Crash! Here comes this bull, everybody. The whole wall disintegrates. And they're doing this to advertise this kind of a malt liquor. You don't do that at dinner with a friend. No, all of you play the same game. You sit down and you have drawn up the rules subconsciously and quietly before you sit down at this table at dinner. You know you're going to talk about anybody and everybody as long as they're not there at that table. If they're there at the table, they're off limits. You do not attack each other over this dinner. You attack the people at the other table over there. And, of course, that's when you drop your voice way down as it's sitting right over here. Have you ever seen such a bag? Look at that hat. Oh, yeg. You know, and you're talking about other people. I've seen people in restaurants, two human beings, husband and wife, sitting across from each other, table for two. They do not look at each other. She is staring over here. His face is here. He's staring over there. Her face is here. They kind of look and they watch till somebody comes in and sits down they don't like, and then they look at that, you know, and they talk to each other about that person. And I'm thinking to myself, I've seen this dozens of times because I'm a kind of a people watcher myself. I'm an observer of human nature. And I think how miserable they must be. They can find nothing to talk about. They're not interested in each other. They don't like each other's face. They've got nothing to share in common except pass me the salt. They might not even say that. Get up and walk around and grab it to avoid saying anything to their spouse. But oh, do they love to talk about other people. Now, the reason I am leading up to this is because of what Jesus Christ of Nazareth says and because of what God requires of us. Let's look at Proverbs 25 and verse 15. 25 and verse 15. By long forbearing is a prince or a judge, as it can read in the Hebrew, persuaded. That's long patience. Tiresome, repetitive, quiet, calm, objective, and respectful explanation. Not by emotional outbursts, not by anger. And a soft tongue breaks the bone. I want to tell you a little story one time, what happened to me. We were coming back down to the feast at Squaw Valley, and I was flying the Fanjet Falcon. We had a little dog aboard, a little Poco in our family, and Dan Spencer and I were there flying together. And we had come down from Penticton, I believe, and we always had to go over to Seattle to clear customs, U.S. customs, but we decided to clear them in Reno. Well, it was on a Sunday. And U.S. customs are closed on Sundays. You have to pay them time and a half. They actually kind of fine you, in a sense, and make you pay for the time of this customs officer who comes out. Now, whenever you make out your flight plan, an international flight plan, you must always add in the remarks, ADCUS means advise customs. So once we were in the air, we get on what is called air rank, and that is a ground, an air-to-ground telephone. And we got air rank, and we had them dial the airport in Reno to make sure that the U.S. customs were notified. Yes, they assured us they'd been notified. In the landing pattern, as we were approaching Reno, we called the tower and asked them, we're coming from Canada. This is an international flight. Have customs been notified? Affirmative, Alpha Charlie, they've been notified. We landed, taxied up to Butler Aviation. The man came out, and we told him where we'd arrived from, and he said, well, we said, where's the customs man? Well, I'm sorry, no one told us about customs. He's not here. Some kind of a stupid breakdown in communications. The customs man had not been notified. Quickly, Dan got on the telephone and told the customs man that there we were, and we just arrived from Canada. He was still at home somewhere in Reno, and he just blew up. He was just madder than you know what. And I don't want to use that word except in Bible study. And he got in his car and he came over to the Reno airport and he got there. And I mean, he was just like, like somebody had just stuck a needle in him. He was fighting mad. He was just really hopping mad. To have gotten out of his home, maybe he's watching a football game or something, come all the way out the airport to clear this flight through. And he got in there and he wanted to see passports and shot cards, and I mean, he was just going around and around. And Dan Spencer is a very, very fine man. He said, well, Mr. So-and-so, I'm sorry about that. And he just apologized over the place, and he said, I really understand how you feel, and I really hate it that you didn't get the notice in advance, but here's our copy of our flight plan, and I could get you on, you could talk to the tower, and he was just so mild. And so here was Poco back there, my little dog, and he came back in there, and he was real gruff and looking around among everybody, and here was Poco kind of looking up like this, his tongue sticking out, and he looked at the dog and reached down and kind of scratched him. Poco kind of wagged his tail. And this customs man began to kind of smile a little bit, and I was very pleasant with him, and Dan was very pleasant with him, and we apologized all over the place. And boy, after a while, he said, oh, well, that's all right, folks. I don't need you to open up any suitcase. Just go right on through. And he exited with a big smile on his face. Now, he came there absolutely loaded for bear, and all we had to do was just react to his attitude. Say, well, look, here's our flight plan. We called from Air Rank, and we can prove it. We called the tower. What are you getting on us for? Now, isn't that the normal reaction? When somebody comes and just is really hitting you head on with a lot of bile, a lot of hatred, a lot of anger, don't you tend to kind of react back? Well, for some reason, I guess it was during the feast. I guess it was the rich food of the real great sermons that we were hearing and sermons that I was able to preach and being with all of God's people and during the Feast of Tabernacles. We just didn't do that. We just gave a kind, mild, patient answer. And that customs official was the most friendly guy. He was a red-headed guy. And we cleared customs in there 2 or 3 years after that. And he'd always come in, the kindest guy we ever met. It was just won over. I tell you, it works. By long forbearing, and there's another prophecy that says, another proverb rather, that says, a soft answer turns away wrath. Now, what kind of people are we supposed to be? What kind of people are going to make it into God's kingdom? In Romans 12, verses 1 and 2, is a very great spiritual principle about what God expects of us. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. It's not unreasonable. that God wants us to become His slave. We are His property. We belong to Him. He owns us. We do not possess our own lives, truly. We're His children, even if we don't recognize it. Even if we're carnal out here in the streets, we are breathing His air. We're walking on His good green earth. We are eating His fruits and vegetables. We are drinking of His water. For in Him we live and move and have our being. It is God who gives us every beat of our heart and every breath of air. It is not unreasonable that we conform to Him, that we love Him, that we worship Him, that we present ourselves back to Him because He has given us our life. And, verse 2, be not conformed to this world, to this society, to these governments, and to these various traditions and religions, but be you changed, be you converted, be you transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. We are to be transformed, we are to be absolutely changed. Now, basically, what is our attitude as we go through life? Does almost everything anybody does in your circle of friends or where you work or where you live tend to bug you? That's a modern term, you know, from insects running around. We don't like insects. We think of them as being a bug. And so we adopt the word, does it bug you or does it bother you? Are most other people with whom you come in contact kind of stupid in your eyes? Are you continually elevating yourself by saying, you talk about dumb. I mean, you talk about stupid. Let me tell you this one. You know what you're doing? You're trying to jack yourself up into the air by putting the other person down. You're showing your great glamorous intelligence in contrast to their alleged stupidity. But have you gone to them? Have you told them about their stupidity? Said, look, John, George, Hank, or Dick, I just want to take you aside and tell you, you're really quite a stupid person, you know. You're really kind of dumb. And every time I'm with somebody else and you're not around, I'm telling everybody how stupid you are. And to me, it's like a disease. I mean, let's face it, you need to be cured of your stupidity. But no, we don't do that. Recently, I had occasion once again to see a problem develop, and it hurts me that these problems develop this way. A third party, fourth party, will contact you and tell you of some untoward, awkward, or sinful, or whatever condition that some other people got into. How do they find out about it? One of the participants came to them. What happened? Where did Christ's message break down? Anybody want to volunteer? Why is this third party involved? Why did the person who allegedly is repenting of sin or feels ashamed over having done something not go to the person with whom this evil deed was shared and work it out between the two of them and then get on their knees and confess it to Christ? Why do they go to a third person? Well, because a lot of times we human beings lack the faith to know that Jesus Christ is a living high priest who really does forgive, who does hear, and who will act on what he hears, and will just wipe the slate clean, and we will seek out a person always whom we feel to be the most spiritual. And I think I said that a week or so ago because it does annoy me that nearly always those who gradually build up a reputation for being, quote, the most spiritual in any given congregation are usually those who become the repositories of all the evil that goes on in the congregation. They're the people to whom all the people will run. The people will trot to them with their problems, especially to somebody else's problem. And so these spiritual ones become the catch-all, the place to gather all of the rotten little things that go on. You wives, do your husbands almost always do the wrong thing around the house? Do their habits annoy you? They got bad breath, B.O., you know, the way they put their clothes down in the closet or throw them around or sling them around. They don't help you make the bed. They're not all good with the dishes. Is the very fact that your husbands are in the kitchen and running, you know, sometimes cooking your own breakfast nettlesome to the wives? Look at the mess you made. And you husbands, do your wives get on your nerves to the point that practically everything they do bothers you or bugs you? Are there a lot of things about them that you just really can't abide? Employees, if you work for a boss, do your overseers almost never understand your problems? Do they bother you? Do they totally ignore your great talent? They pass you over month after month for a raise, too little wages, don't appreciate your input, don't ask you for your opinion, treat you brusquely or crudely? You bosses, don't your employees almost invariably do the wrong thing? Aren't they clumsy, kind of butterfingered, all thumbs, kind of stupid? And aren't they also out to get your job? Aren't they plotting secretly to jerk the rug out from under you, to stab you in the back, and go behind your back to the boss, get you removed, and take your position away from you? And most of all, aren't they stupid and aren't they lazy? And not worth their salt, and you shouldn't even be paying them the kind of a salary that you give them. And they're never on time, and they're undependable. And you workers, aren't your bosses doing the best they can to take away what little authority you've got and undermining you, deriding you? Isn't it about the whole world against you when you get right down to it? You know, it gets so that when we hear the deeds of others, we say, oh no, you gotta be kidding. And we screw our face up into an ugly grimace and we say, well, would you believe what that jackass did? Now, I've got to ask, in the midst of all this humanity that we're sharing for a moment, what kind of personality must we have? Speaking of personality, what kind of a person are we in our interpersonal human relationships with each other? What kind of a personality is it going to take to get into God's kingdom? Now, we know that Jesus Christ was the express nature or character or personality of Almighty God. Let's take a look at what Christ's personality was like. Let's go just to some rather strange areas maybe you wouldn't think of immediately as being an example, but let's go to the 8th chapter of the book of Matthew. This is an example that I think is a good one. Jesus Christ of Nazareth was here hearing about a servant of a centurion that was sick. He was entered into Capernaum. There came unto him a centurion, beseeching him and saying, Lord, my servant lies at home, sick of the palsy, grievously tormented. Now, none of the Jews thought much of the Romans. The Romans had placed Herod the Great and then his son on the throne. He had run over to Cyprus to get his bid in after the incredible debacle up at Actium. He had been placed on the throne and he had died. Then his son came along and the entire line of the Herods were known as gross, and they were known as men of unbelievable, unbounded appetites. They were despised by the Jewish people. But the Jewish people also had an occupying force, and there was no love lost about the Romans, because the Romans would brutally move old people out of their little hovels and move in and sleep on their beds and make them sleep outside or on the floor. They would take an elderly person and put the Roman mail sack on him and make him walk down the road a couple of miles and bear the burden of a soldier. They would rob them. They would extort money from them, brandishing arms. They would ask for favors of them. They were mostly illiterates, like a lot of Carthaginians or people from the southern provinces of Italy or from Asia and the Middle East that were conscripts and were mercenaries in the Roman legions. Most of them didn't know how to read or how to write. They couldn't even speak the Hebrew language. And they would make surly gestures and, of course, make bawdy comments about the little Jewish daughters. There was no reason for any Jew to say anything except something rather surly, or to keep his head down, a very even expression, and to kind of mumble something and do what some Roman told him to. So here comes a Roman officer, over 100 men, to Jesus Christ and requests a healing. And instead of Jesus putting him down, saying, you ought to be ashamed of yourself, taking this as an opportunity to take a good dig at the Roman army, by the way, you know, you wouldn't believe some of the things your troops have been doing. You wouldn't believe the stories I've been hearing about the conduct of some of these soldiers here that belong to your own coterion of 100. Not at all. Jesus was kind. He said, I'll come and heal him. Didn't make a single statement about his uniform or his breastplate or his helmet or the sword at his side. I'll come and heal him. The centurion said, I'm not worthy to come under your roof. And you know the rest of the story. Jesus said, I have not found faith like this in all of Israel. Let's look at another example in the 8th chapter, verse 25 and 26. His disciples were out here. The ship was being swamped with waves. It was tossing and pitching, and the disciples were very, very upset. And, of course, they began to get emotional. The disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, Lord, save us, we perish. And he said unto them, why are you fearful, O you of little faith? Then he arose and rebuked the wind and the sea, and there was great calm. But notice the way he acted toward them. He gave them a lesson. There was a mild rejoinder, almost like a rebuke. But he didn't become hugely angry. He didn't rub it in. He let go of it. A mild rebuke. Why are you fearful? You have little faith. Great calm. And he just let them go ahead and talk about it. discuss among themselves, "Wow, did you see that?" And for the rest of the hours of the voyage, discuss the powers that he had. He didn't say, "Now come here and sit down, I want to tell you something." He was not that kind of a person. Christ's personality was the most balanced, the kindest, the wisest, the most even-tempered, the most, in that sense, easygoing personality of any human being that has ever lived. There was no way that you could find vanity in him. You could not, in some way, make a dig at Christ that would trigger a carnal response, because there was no carnality. You could slap him, and he'd turn the other cheek. You could spit on him, and he'd look at you pitifully. You could lash his back to bloody ribbons, and he would say, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do." You could say, "If you're the Son of God," and he wouldn't say, "What do you mean, if? I'll show you who I am," because there was no vanity. He just didn't even hear that kind of a statement, because it didn't trigger any reaction in him whatsoever. He was not short-tempered. He wasn't instant anger. He did not constantly put other people down to raise himself up in your esteem, because humility goes before greatness. In example after example, if you read into his life and see what he did, you can see many examples of how Jesus reacted. Verse 11 of chapter 9 of the book of Matthew, just going along through this account, historical account. When the Pharisees saw it, now they're in this house, this is Simon's house, and talking here about, no, this was in his own house, I believe, and the Pharisees came, because it's right after the healing of the sick with the palsy. Yes, in verse 10, "As Jesus sat at meat in the house, behold, many publicans and sinners came and sat down with him and his disciples." Now these were people who were of known bad reputation. It doesn't say what kind of sinners, but even people in the community knew that they were sinners. And the Pharisees saw it, and of course they were very, very conscious of status. They were the self-righteous people at the head of the religion, and they would not so much as soil their hands with touching some of these dirty so-and-sos the way they looked at it, always making comparisons. When the Pharisees saw it, they said unto his disciples, "Why does your master eat with publicans and sinners?" You know, I remember an occasion where I decided I wanted to have a beer on the way home from the office. And I was all the way down 155, and I was just thirsty. And I'm not going to apologize to anybody for the fact that I was thirsty and decided to have a beer. Okay? Not going to apologize. There's a little club out there. It used to be a restaurant. I've been in there probably twice my whole life. But I stopped in there and ordered a can of beer. A couple of guys knew me, and they came up and started talking. There's a couple of pool tables in there, and the owner knew me, and he recognized me and came over and started talking. So I'm having my beer. I'm about to leave. Just as I was walking out the door, a person whom shall remain unnamed came bursting in the door, was absolutely shocked to see me there. Surprised the daylights out of him, I think. Mumbled something about using a telephone. I said, "Oh, well, there's a telephone right there in the wall." Mumbled something about his car or his children or his wife or something, and then embarrassedly fled. Puzzled, I looked out the door, and he was walking across about two parking lots and had left his station wagon parked in the parking lot of an automobile dealership over there, two doors away. I puzzled over that all the way home. Next morning, I'm still puzzling over it. I mentioned it to Benny. I told him who it was, and I told him about this. I said, "I can't figure that out. You don't suppose he was meeting somebody there or something, and he saw me and it embarrassed him?" And Benny said, "Oh, no. Don't you understand? He saw your car there, and he was spying on you. He was checking out what you were doing, and he saw you in there. He thought you were going to be in some compromised situation." I said, "You got to be kidding. I couldn't even imagine that that was so." Later on, I heard it coming back from all parts of the United States about me carousing around in this drunken environment with all of these people, and it is enormous. It's unbelievable. So I know what it's like. "Why does your master eat with publicans and sinners?" You know, Jesus was actually eating with sinners every time he sat down to a meal with his disciples. Did you know that Jesus never shook the hand of a converted man? Did you know that Jesus never had a conversation with a person in whom was the Holy Spirit? Do you know that he never looked upon another human being who had the Spirit of God and who was converted? Think about that. Every one of his friends were carnal. And yet it didn't brush off on him. So the Pharisees, of course, they were very class conscious. And when Jesus heard that, he said unto them, "They that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick." You know, people do not believe the best of you when they see you in certain environments. It's like if I am in my office and I have got my feet up on the desk and I have a newspaper opened, it is obvious to anybody who walks in that I am absolutely not busy. I'm not doing anything, right? Wrong. How in the world am I going to keep up and to know what is going on in the Middle East, in Poland, in over there in Jordan, to have the store of knowledge that I have accumulated and to maintain that store of knowledge and to keep aware and abreast of what's going on if I don't read the newspaper? But many people assume that when you're a minister or you're in the office or whatever and you're reading, you're not busy. You're just relaxing. Well, now I have to admit that sometimes my body becomes a little supine at moments when I'm reading, but my mind is busy. You can't hear it whirring around, but I am really seeing through these glasses words. And those words are triggering thoughts, and those thoughts... Later on, they're probably going to come out, and you're going to hear about them. That is, if I can go ahead and read. So sometimes, you know, you want to assume that just because a person appears to be lazy or appears to be doing something that is not all that heavy work, you don't have a shovel in your hand, the perspiration isn't just rolling off of you, maybe you're working nevertheless. Jesus gave a very beautiful answer, I think. Those that be whole need not a physician, but they that are sick. Sure, he hobnobbed with people who were carnal and rubbed shoulders with them and chatted with them and listened to them and was among them because he was a great example to them, because he wanted to know what made them tick and what their problems were, and he wanted to give to them and share with them, and he wanted to call them. He wanted to lead them into a righteous way of life. But you go and learn what this means. I will have mercy and not sacrifice, for I am not come to call the righteous, and let's us remember that. We're not here to proselyte from other churches or to try to attack them or to get them to leave. We are here to go to the world and call sinners to repentance. How are you going to get a sinner to repent if you never talk to him? If you never see him, never speak to him? If you just walk around through this life keeping yourself totally away from anybody that you call a sinner, disdainfully looking down upon them? And so there's so many examples like this. If you just think of Christ's personality, the way he was, the way he acted. In the 23rd verse of the same chapter, he's in the ruler of the synagogue's home, and he came and saw these professional wailers and minstrels making a noise. Verse 24, he said, "Give place, the maid is not dead, but sleeps." And they laughed him to scorn. Doesn't say what they said, but you can imagine what they said. In our vernacular, they'd say, "Who is this guy? You gotta be kidding. You come in here and say, for hours she's been lying there dead. Don't you see? What, you think they're standing over there weeping and wailing? The professional mourners are here. You come in here. What a cruel joke. Who are you saying this to this family?" And so on. And they just scorned him. Instead of pulling himself up to his full height and giving them a great blast of the power and the authority that he represented, he didn't take umbrage. He didn't say a word, but he asked Jairus, and quietly, "Come on, folks, it's time to go." And they were all asked to leave the private quarters. He didn't say a word to them. When the people were put forth, he went in and took her by the hand, and the maid arose, and the fame thereof went abroad into all that land. Now, you can think of example after example. Let's go on to Mark, the 7th chapter, and verse 24. I think this is a very good one. Mark 7 and verse 24. Here was a woman who could only be called pesky, somebody that was really just walking along, plucking on his sleeve and just bothering him. She'd been bothering the disciples, and they were bothered, and they wanted to do something about it. They had the normal carnal reaction. Mark 7, verse 24. "From thence he arose, went into the borders of Tyre and Sidon, and entered into a house, and would have no man know it, but he could not be hid because of his fame. For a certain woman, whose young daughter had an unclean spirit, heard about him, and came and fell at his feet." The woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by nation, and she besought him that he would cast forth the demon out of her daughter. But Jesus said unto her, "Let the children first be filled, for it's not fit to take the children's bread and cast it unto the dogs." He wasn't calling her a dog. He was giving an analogous example of how he was not called except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and that salvation is of the Jews, and that the children, meaning the Jewish race and Israel, should have the gospel first. And she could have been very angry and turned away, but she maybe had learned some of those principles we read from the Book of Solomon.
that you persevere with a judge or a righteous person or a person in authority, that you have patience, that you don't blow up, you don't get angry and turn away and say, well, if you feel that way, you called me a dog. No, no, no. The reward she was after was more precious to her than any temporary enjoyment of some little bit part out of a movie. A little moment of posturing, well, I never, and then turning away, was not important to her, but it is important to some of us. We love those little vignettes of life, those moments when we are center stage and we are able to haughtily stalk out. Well, if that's the way you feel, goodbye, slam. It's a very, doors were invented, as some people think, for the purpose of emphasizing anger. Many homes have doors that are rather creaky, you know, and there's little cracks around the locks because they've been slammed so frequently because people act that way. Now, even this woman, a Greek, a Syrophoenician, did not act that way. She said, yes, Lord, yet the dogs under the table eat of the children's crumbs. And he said unto her, for this saying, go your way, for the devil has gone out of your daughter, and he healed her. And when she was come to her house, she found the demon had gone out, and her daughter again laying upon the bed. Many examples of him I want to show you in Mark the 8th chapter, beginning in verse 1, where he could have said, what dumb clods, what poor preparation, let them learn their own lesson, but he didn't. This was the day of the feeding of these great multitudes, and he said, I have compassion on the multitude, because they've now been with me 3 days, verse 2, and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away fasting to their own houses, they will faint by the way, for divers of them come from far. What was his attitude? What would yours have been? I have to ask myself, what would mine have been? Here are these hangers-on. You talk about dumb, they're like a bunch of turkeys. How can somebody just go along here, they've got no money in their pocket, they should have turned back 20 miles ago, here they are, am I supposed to feed them? It reminds me of the Bill Cosby party record about how Noah was supposed to have been arguing with God and saying, Lord, look here down the, you know, the deck beneath all these animals, who's going to clean up this mess? And it's kind of funny, and yet in a way, maybe it's a little sacrilegious, I don't know, but it's kind of showing that Noah was a human being and kind of argued with God. And Cosby, of course, is not a converted man. And it's kind of funny, but on the other hand, there's a little bit of a lesson of human nature. Now, Jesus had been carnal. If he had reacted the normal, natural way, he would have talked about how foolish these people were. Lack of provision, lack of foresight, lack of planning, no character, no money. Don't they have a job? Don't they have a home to go to? What is this? Am I the Pied Piper? Everywhere I go, this ragtag motley crowd is following along. They can't even feed themselves. Oh, no. He had compassion. And his disciples answered him, from whence can a man satisfy these men with bread here in the wilderness? And, of course, then came the miracle of 4,000 people being fed. And it wasn't until they were fed that he sent them away on a full stomach with the best food that man has ever eaten, because it was created by Almighty God. It should have been pretty good bread and pretty good fish, I would think. Another example, in verse 10, let's just read this. Straightway he entered into a ship with his disciples and came into the parts of Dalmatia. And the Pharisees came forth and began to question him, seeking of him a sign from heaven, tempting him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit. It was just a big sigh of sadness, but he didn't get angry. He didn't put them down, but he did give an example. Why does this generation seek after a sign? Verily I say unto you, there shall no sign be given unto this generation. And he left them and entered into the ship again and departed to the other side. There are so many examples like that, you could just pick them out, and you could just think, what was his personality? What was his reaction? Read the Bible, read the New Testament examples of Christ, of the personal aspects of it, how he was with Peter's mother-in-law when she was sick, how he was with the women, how he was with Mary when she came out and said, if you'd only gotten here earlier at Lazarus' tomb, and so on. And what was his emotion? What was his reaction? And then you drink out of the Bible a little bit of the personality of Jesus Christ, that perfect personality, as well as just the doctrine, and it becomes human and personal to you. And that was exactly what I was trying to do in writing the book Peter's Story and the last portion of The Real Jesus, is to cause people to drink in of those things. Let's notice Ephesians, the 4th chapter. Ephesians 4, a couple of very meaty scriptures are Ephesians 4 and Colossians 3. He says, beginning in verse 14, breaking into the middle of that thought about the purpose of the ministry and the reason why God has a church to bring us all into that perfect man, the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, verse 14, that we henceforth be no more children, tossed to and fro and carried about with every wind of doctrine, by the sleight of men and cunning craftiness whereby they lie in wait to deceive, but speaking the truth in love, may grow up into him in all things. That means mentally and emotionally, to control our spirit, to control our attitude, as well as doctrinal knowledge, faithfully attending on the Sabbath, paying tithes, going to the holy days. No, the changing of the spirit, the changing of the character, the development of the personality is where it's at. Grow up into him in all things, which is the head, even Christ, from whom the whole body, that's the whole spiritual organism that is the church, fitly joined together and compacted by that which every joint supplies, according to the effectual working and the measure of every part, makes increase of the body under the edifying of itself in love. A very beautiful and lengthy way of putting it by the Apostle Paul. This I say therefore and testify in the Lord, that you do not walk from now on or live your daily way of life as the other Gentiles walk, in the vanity of their mind, having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God through the ignorance that is in them because of the hardness or the blindness of their heart, who being past feeling, so they're callous, they're not sensitive, they don't respond and react to God's Spirit, have given themselves over unto lasciviousness. That's total licentiousness, nihilistic, amoral, absolutely without any kind of principle, just living according to the emotion, the appetites, reacting according to the whims of the moment, to work all uncleanness with greediness. But you have not so learned Christ. If so be that you have heard him and have been taught by him as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off concerning the former conduct, it should read, not conversation, way of life, conduct, the old you, the old man, which is corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. Lusts, drives, pulls, appetites in your body, which are deceitful. You want exoneration. You want understanding. You want empathy and sympathy. You want people to agree with your point of view and to disagree with the other person's point of view. That's a deceitful lust. You want more money, more material things. That's a deceitful lust. It can deceive you and get you off on a wrong direction, going in the wrong way, away from God. And be renewed in the spirit of your mind, and that you put on the new man, which after God is created in righteousness and true holiness. Now, if we are to the point where we are still enraged and angered by some small, trivial slight, by some unkind word, by some misunderstanding, then how mature are we as Christians? And how far have we really developed when we are unable to control our spirit, but just fly into a mindless rage over seemingly trivial things? And that you put on the new man, which after God is created in righteousness and true holiness, wherefore, putting away lying, exaggerating, false witnessing, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we're members one of another. Be you angry. If you get angry, don't sin. Don't answer back. Don't seek vengeance. You control it. You don't lash out. You don't become spiteful. You don't shout and yell and throw a tantrum. Sin not. Let not the sun go down on your wrath. God's Word tells us there should never be a time when we go to bed at night that we have not forgiven from our heart every human being on the face of the earth, even the person we feel is our bitterest enemy. That we should never go to sleep with any wrath. Have you ever experienced the time where you went to bed at night and you woke up and you were still angry over something that happened the day before? I think we all have. You had to almost remember, what was I angry about? Oh yeah, I remember. Ooh, that makes me mad. You'd almost totally forgotten it during the night, but you wake up and you didn't really give it to God and repent and forgive and everything. You retained it. And what did that do to your sleep? And what does that do to your breakfast and to your body? What does it do to your stomach, as I mentioned at the beginning of this sermon today? The whole thing is of the mind, of the spirit, of the personality. Let's conclude with Colossians 3. Again, very similar language. But it says, we used to walk in these things mortify your members upon the earth, verse 5, Colossians 3, and then he says in verse 7, in the which you also walked sometime when you lived in them, but now you also put away from you all these things, anger, wrath, malice. Sometimes we are malicious, we bear malice, that's a long-term kind of a spiteful anger and hostility toward other people, blasphemy, wrong language, wrong words, blaspheming God by either words or by our actions, filthy communication. I think we all make mistakes in that direction, and we sin in that direction. We should not. Out of your mouth, lie not one to another, seeing that you have put off the old man with his deeds, and have put on the new man, like we read in Romans 12, 1 and 2, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. Put on, therefore, verse 12, since we're all the same, Jew, Gentile, etc., as the elect of God, holy and beloved, bowels of mercies. Now that just means a really deep feeling of mercy, of a longing, a yearning that actually kind of constricts the intestines, and you feel it, in a sense, right in your midsection. Kindness, humbleness or humility of mind, meekness, long-suffering, forbearing one another. That means putting up with one another. That means making allowance for somebody else's mistake. And forgiving one another. If any man have a quarrel against any, even as Christ forgave you, so also do ye. And above all things, put on charity, which is that outgoing charitable love, which is the bond of perfection or perfectness. Well, I believe that a lot of us still have a long way to go. I know that I certainly do in those directions. And I think it's good to be reminded that the only way we're going to be inside God's kingdom is if we rule. And we cannot do it on our own strength, our own spirit. You could never do it carnally. It has to come from an exterior source. It has to come from God's Holy Spirit. Because what I'm telling you, what the Bible tells us about the way we are to react to others who belittle us, who hurt us, who speak evil of us, who bear tales against us, who physically abuse us, who cut us down or whatever, it's not normal. It's not natural for us to take that with graciousness and say, thank you, brother, and I forgive you, I understand. That's unnatural. That's spiritual. And it has to come from the Holy Spirit of God, from an outside source. And that can only come through faith and through prayer and through Bible study, of drinking in and hearing and leaning on Jesus Christ's own spirit and attitude and having His nature inside of us. We could never do it on our own. So this next week, try to catch yourself a couple of times somewhere along the way, on the job, at home, as you go about, and see your attitude begin to boil up and begin to get carnal somewhere. See if you can detect it. See if you can arrest it. And remember that one rather earthy proverb, the beginning of strife is as when one letteth out water. Therefore, leave off strife before it be meddled with.